Church, we are so excited to have the event that is going on this evening, a book for our time of terror, Lord of the Rings, a conversation with Tolkien expert Dr. Ralph Wood, brought to us by the Kalos Foundation, and you'll hear a little bit more about that in a minute. I just simply wanted to welcome you to our facility. My name is Philip Dancy. I'm the pastor here at Sylvania Church, and we are delighted to be putting this on tonight. I wanted to give you the practical stuff tonight. I don't normally get to do that, and so I'm kind of excited about getting to do that. And so if you need to use a restroom at any point during the evening, to my left, this doorway that way, there's a ladies' restroom there. To my right, there's a men's restroom there. And then if you exit through this way and go down the hallway back to the left, there are two restrooms down that way as well. The general format, I believe, and you'll hear a little bit more about this in a second, is that there will be a 30-minute lecture, 30-minute Q&A, another 30-minute lecture with another 30-minute optional Q&A at the end. And so if you need to leave before that, you'll find out about that later. And so I would like to actually turn it over now to Dr. Randy Randall, a former elder here at Sylvania, and the sort of founder of the Kalos Foundation, who's kind of gotten all this together, and he will carry us forward from here. So.
I was reading just this past week and came across a work by Charles Osgood, and he's written a book with somewhat odd title that is Poetry as a Means of Grace. He has said this about literature, that it extends the range of vision, intellectual, moral, and spiritual. It expands the compass of our sympathy. It sharpens our discernment. It corrects our appraisal of all things. So here we have a story of the Hobbit and a story of the Lord of the Rings. And the question is, can it really transform a life? Well, indeed it can, and Dr. Ralph Wood is here tonight to show us how. Dr. Wood was born and raised in East Texas and even schooled in East Texas, and he attended what is now known as Texas A&M at Commerce for his bachelor's degree and for his master's degree. In his master's degree, he wrote a thesis on the works of Flannery O'Connor. He obtained his Ph.D. from the University of Chicago and began teaching at Wake Forest. There he taught for some 26 years. He's also taught at other schools around the nation and in Canada, including Samford University, Regent College in Vancouver, and Providence College. But since 1998, he has been the university professor of theology and literature at Baylor University. He also holds many other positions and awards, and they're really too numerous to mention tonight in the real sense of the word. He's written at least 7 books, and I will have to commend him that his books have some of the most intriguing titles I have ever heard. So you need to go out and buy all 7, okay? Here's at least 3. Flannery O'Connor and the Christ-Haunted South. Chesterton and the Nightmare Goodness of God. And the Gospel According to Tolkien. As you might expect from that list, he is an expert in several authors, including Flannery O'Connor and G.K. Chesterton, but also an expert in men such as C.S. Lewis and Walker Percy. And, of course, as you likely know by your attendance here tonight, he is an expert in J.R.R. Tolkien and his two best-known books, The Hobbit and The Lord of the Rings. Now, there's been a bit of a change in our plan for this evening, as you have already heard from Philip. Originally, we had planned to talk about the Lord of the Rings and to show how faith, hope, and love answer questions of the terrors that occur in the Lord of the Rings and the various evils that occur there. But Dr. Wood, in reflecting on the whole story, has decided that we need to change things a bit, and I've encouraged him to proceed as he sees fit. And that is that we're going to talk about the man Tolkien first for about 30 minutes, then have a Q&A of around 30 minutes or so there, and then talk about the Hobbit, and then a Q&A to follow. Now, the reason for that is that it's very interesting. When you read a story, one of the most important things is who wrote it. What was the man like? What did he think about? What was he trying to achieve? What kind of a man would write a story like these? And Dr. Wood is very familiar with Tolkien and can help us there as well. And then, of course, the foundational book in the Lord of the Rings series is The Hobbit, which preceded it. And what is the story there? What is going on there? What are the hobbits really like? What are the links to our society today? So all of these questions, Dr. Wood has been excited to talk to us tonight about, and I can't wait to hear what he has to say. Dr. Wood?
Thank you very much. My, I'm astonished that on a Friday evening, anybody would come out to hear an egghead. As we all know, the real religion of Texas is football. And that deity is worshipped on Friday night, even in the playoff time. So thank you very, very much for coming. Thank you, Pastor Dancy, for having opened the Sylvania Church to this very important, to me, ecumenical gathering, since so many of us from across the various Christian traditions are here. But especially to Dr. Randy Randall and his lovely wife, Linda, who've been really the moving forces behind this whole idea. And they're hosting us very graciously in their lovely home. I've long been a kind of admirer of Tyler as a city. I grew up behind the Pine Curtain, as we call it in Waco, namely East Texas, God's country. And I always thought Tyler was the most beautiful city in East Texas. You've got the Rose Festival. You've got the Azalea. Somebody can have other views, I gather. You're laughing. The Rose Festival, the Azalea Festival, wonderful historic downtown brick street section. The best medical care in East Texas. No one seems to me can contest that. So when my wife's sister and our brother-in-law were deciding where they would retire after coming, having spent most of their adult life in California, they chose Tyler, and they chose very well. So we're back here regularly, and it's a delight to be with you tonight. Try to cast your minds back to the year 1936. What was happening in 1936? Of course, Hitler had risen to power already. He gained control of the German government. He had already begun persecution of the Jews. He had already begun his wicked eugenics program to try to weed out those unworthy of life. He had begun branding homosexuals and gypsies with various stigmas. The storm clouds were, of course, gathering over all of Europe. And England knew that eventually it would not be able to be immune from what was about to erupt. And yet a man named John Ronald Reuel Tolkien, a very unlikely name, was sitting at a desk in one of what we call the red brick universities. That is to say, not Oxford, Cambridge, Edinburgh, St. Andrews, the four old, old universities. Grading papers, the bane of a professor's existence. I'm doing it right now, so I can tell you. When my mother retired from teaching after 40 years, I said to her, "Do you miss anything?" She says, "Not a thing." I miss grading least of all. In Britain, professors don't make anything. And Tolkien had a family of four, and to support that family, he had to grade papers at other universities. Because the British have a double check system. You're not graded merely by your professor, but by a professor in another university. And so, as he was turning what we call the blue books, how many of you ever encountered blue books? Good. He came to a blank page. And it struck him suddenly as a matter of great relief and gift to have a blank page rather than student scribbling. And so he found himself, now listen to my language, I'm speaking what's called the passive voice. He found himself writing the following sentence, which I trust all of you know. "In a hole in the ground there lived a hobbit." Where did that come from? He had no idea. It just occurred to him. In a hole in the ground there lived a hobbit. Now, we're going to see Tolkien regards language as revelatory. Language is the means by which we receive revelation. And so he began to ask himself, well, what would a hobbit be? And with his massive knowledge of languages, he knew 14 languages, by the way, most of them long since extinct. He remembered that the old English word holbitla, H-O-L-B-Y-T-L-A, holbitla means hole dweller, one who dwells in tunnels beneath the ground. So a hobbit must be a hole dweller. And so he hit upon the idea of doing what he did every year, and that is to write a book for his, usually a set of verses with their illustrations. In this case, to spin out over actually 2 years, a story for his own children called The Hobbit. And by 1937, he had finished that book. His kids fell in love with it. They gave it to their neighborhood friends in Oxford. Those friends loved it. And so someone came to Tolkien and said, you really ought to have this published. This is more than just another little book you've dashed off. And so the book was sent to Rayner Unwin, one of the most prestigious publishers in Britain. And he said, I'll put it to the test. My 14-year-old son will be the one who decides whether this book gets published or not. If he likes it, we'll publish it. His son liked it. And it was published. In 1938, it became a smash success instantly, and thus was launched what surely must be called the unlikeliest revolution thinkable. That is, J.R.R. Tolkien, an obscure Oxford professor nobody had ever heard of, began to ally himself with a man named Clive Staples Lewis. That's even a worse name than John Ronald Reuel Tolkien. And to gather a group called the Inklings. Wonderful nickname. They all dabbled in ink. They were writers long before computers, even before typewriters in their case. They all wrote by hand, of course, dipping their pens in the ink. And all of them very deeply convinced Christians. And those two men wrought the largest revolution in Christian imaginative writing in the 20th century. Stunning that that all should have begun on an afternoon at probably Bristol University in the west of England, as Tolkien wrote the sentence, "In a hole in the ground there lived a hobbit." Tolkien and Lewis had been friends since 1927 or 8. Both of them on the faculty at Oxford. And Lewis at that time had fallen away from his Christianity entirely. He no longer went to church, no longer called himself a Christian, had embraced a kind of atheism. On the following grounds, he said, in good Marxist fashion, good Freudian fashion, the Christian story is a beautiful myth. It's a lovely dream. It's a wonderful kind of poem, the notion that God would become human, that God would take human form, would put himself in our place, would take upon himself the sins of the world, die for those sins, be resurrected into eternal life, so that we might have eternal life ourselves here and now. He said that's a beautiful lie, a lie breathed through silver, but still a lie. Because he says all the world's myths are about dying and rising gods, about virgins conceiving and having babies. And therefore the Christian myth is just another myth. On a long walk that lasted until 2 a.m. in the Deer Park outside Magdalen College at Oxford, where Lewis was living and teaching, Tolkien made the following case. Tolkien said, yes, it's right. The Christian story resembles many of the stories, not only of the Western mythical tradition, but even of the Eastern, Asian mythical tradition, with one difference. One huge difference. Jesus is not a myth. Israel is not a mythic people. Israel is an historical people. Christians claim Jesus as the Messiah of Israel. We have records of his death attested outside Christian scriptures. We have the fact that among dozens of messiahs who tried to lead revolts in ancient Israel. They all petered out, except one. One. After whom there came this unbelievable explosion called Christian faith, called the church. Therefore, this is one and only one time when myth became truth, when myth became history, when the deepest dreams and longings of the human imagination were realized. And therefore, this is not a lie breathed through silver. This is the world's one true story. Lewis embraced that argument. He came back into the church. He and Tolkien became very close friends, and around them were gathered a half a dozen other friends who met once a week to read stories to each other, usually in their rooms at Oxford, Tolkien at Merton College, Lewis at Magdalen College. And let us be clear, as Baptists like me, also meeting at the Eagle and Child. Have you been to the Eagle and Child? Good. It's called, the nickname is Bird and Baby. It's a place where they quaff beer. Now, notice there's beer in both this book and in the other books. They were not drawn to hard liquor. And to smoke their pipes. They both thought that alcohol of the right kind and tobacco of the right kind, rightly indulged, were among God's great gifts. And they allied themselves in such a fashion as to begin to produce books that overwhelmed the Christian imagination with a new vision of what it's like to be Christian. When Walker Percy, a very important Catholic writer, came to gather a collection of testimonies to people who had been converted to Christianity in the 20th century from the unlikeliest places, the one writer who ranked above all others was C.S. Lewis. When, in the year 2000, the Telegraph, which is Britain's kind of conservative, quasi-Christian paper, took a poll asking its readers to name the single most important book of the 20th century. They overwhelmingly named, The Lord of the Rings. Well, this caused all kind of clucking among the literati, among the sophisticates, among the cultured. Oh, no, that's just a book of escapism. That's not a book that could be called the book of the century. So the bookseller Waterston's is roughly equal to Barnes and Noble in this country, held their own poll. And once again, overwhelmingly, the real book readers of Britain voted that the outstanding book of the 20th century. Well, this just wouldn't do. So the Folio Club had their own little poll. And the Folio Club is the BMW, or the Jaguar, as they say, of British book clubs. This is the really highbrow crowd. They, too, overwhelmingly said, the most important book of the 20th century is The Lord of the Rings. So look what began in 1936. We are here tonight because of what happened in 1936. So let me tell you a little bit about Tolkien, the man, the person. He's born in 1892. And a lot of this is on my website, by the way, and I'll be glad to give it to you after we meet. He's born in 1892 in South Africa. His name is actually, Tolkien is a Dutch name, but they had been English for quite a while, because his father had gone to South Africa, as many young men did in the 1890s, to seek his fortune. And didn't find it. In fact, he fell ill very quickly. Tolkien was born there. His mother had such a hard time giving him birth amidst very primitive medical conditions. She came back to England to have Tolkien's brother, young brother Hilary, born. Soon after Hilary was born, she got word that her husband was seriously ill. Before she could get back to South Africa to tend him, he had died. So it's a very important fact to remember. Tolkien grew up without a father. He lost his father early. In fact, he, having left South Africa before he was two, about the time he was two, maybe early, maybe three, said, I have only one memory, and that is of the horrible spiders. If you've read Tolkien, you know what's coming. spiders are Shelob, of course, is this really horrible spider in The Lord of the Rings. But we have a crew of spiders already in The Hobbit. Mabel Tolkien, Tolkien's mother, was really quite a remarkable woman. She knew and taught her sons Latin, Greek, and French. Even though she was just an educated, what we would say, homemaker. She had no pretensions to any kind of formal, sophisticated education. And when she gets back to England, she discovers that the Tolkien family, as I say, her parents-in-law, are not very interested in helping her rear these two sons. And that they were, by the way, Baptist. That will come back into the story in a minute. Her own parents were Unitarians. They would help her as much as they could, but their circumstances were more limited and couldn't help her a great deal. And Mabel Tolkien managed to alienate both families pretty thoroughly when, crucial fact, in the year 1900, when Tolkien is eight, his brother is six, she converts to Roman Catholicism. Now, if you know anything about British history, you know that until recently, Great Britain was the single most anti-Catholic country in the world. Long history of reasons behind that, of a deep animus against Catholics. And for her to become Catholic with a Unitarian set of parents and a Baptist set of parents-in-law was to do the forbidden. She alienated herself, not willingly, but for the following reason. This is crucial. She wanted a Christianity that would not be the Muzak of her life. She wanted a kind of faith that would be radical, a Christianity that would be countercultural, that would not look like what the culture looks like. Most of our churches are just replicas of the culture. Turn on TV, you get this, come to church, turn it on, same thing. For her, there ought to be a kind of angular witness to the world from the church, which means they can't be like this. And so she became a Roman Catholic. And that was to be the great shaping religious event for Tolkien's life. For in 1904, just 4 years after she had converted to Rome, she died of tuberculosis. A lot of people died of tuberculosis in those years because she'd had to go back to work to support those boys. And Tolkien was fully convinced his mother worked herself to death, which is probably true. She had moved back to Birmingham to be near what's called the Birmingham Oratory. Now, oratory doesn't mean for us what it does for the Roman Catholic tradition. An oratory is a place of prayer. Orare is the Latin word for prayer. And it's actually home to a whole Catholic order called Oratorians, the most famous of whom is John Henry Newman. Newman had established the Catholic Oratory in Birmingham, and Mabel Tolkien knew that if she had her boys brought up under the shadow of the Oratory of Birmingham, they would be deeply inculcated in Catholic Christianity. And they were, in fact, altar boys, both of them, Ronald and Hillary. She had it arranged that she saw she was going to die, that they would then be made the actual, they would be put in the actual care of the Birmingham Oratory under a man named Father Francis Xavier Morgan. If you know the term, Francis Xavier is the first Jesuit missionary to the East. That's almost more Catholic than the Pope. I mean, that's Catholicism of a really serious kind. She wanted those boys to be reared in the church, to be reared in the oratory school, and so they were. Tolkien excelled as a student. He was a first-rate student. But Father Morgan saw that the local Catholic school was not academic enough to really challenge this boy in whose charge he had been put. And so he put both Ronald and Hillary in the King Edward School of Birmingham, where they both, again, throve. For example, get this. When Tolkien was graduated from high school, they performed a Greek play in Greek. High school students. And as a kind of lark, they sang the British national anthem in Greek at their graduation. God Save the King in Greek. Tolkien knew so much Anglo-Saxon that there was hardly anybody at Oxford who could teach him anything new once he got there. He was clearly a star. And Father Morgan saw that he had on his hands a genius, and that he had to really carefully handle that genius. The moment of crisis came when Tolkien fell in love deeply with a young woman named Edith Bratt, B-R-A-T-T. And Father Morgan became very alarmed at this romance, not because he was squeaky about the idea of boys and girls having affection for each other, but he was afraid Tolkien would go off and get married, and that would be the end of his career, his life as a scholar and probably a professor. So he made the following order. You will have no communication of any kind whatsoever with Edith Bratt until you reach your majority of age 21. Tolkien was then 18. That's a 3-year hiatus that Father Morgan has imposed. Now, many of us will think that cruel, will think that unduly harsh. But again, Father Morgan knew what he was doing. So Tolkien then won a major scholarship to Oxford. He became an outstanding student at Oxford. He cared much more already as a young man about the northern world of Icelandic sagas and Norse myths and the Germanic world than about the sunnier world of Greco-Roman culture. If you know anything about Norse mythology, you know it's a very dark world. I think the darkness can be best explained by a passage that can be found in the Venerable Bede's History of Christianity in England, written in the 7th century. Bede asked an Anglo-Saxon chieftain who had been converted to the Christian faith, what was life like as a pagan? And the Anglo-Saxon chief said it was like a sparrow flying into one end of a lighted mead hall and out the other. Now, a mead hall is a drinking hall. It's a great banqueting hall. And, of course, you have to have both ends open for the smoke to escape. So you get the metaphor? From sheer black, dark nothingness into a brief momentary enjoyment of warmth and light back into black nothingness. We come from nowhere. We are going nowhere. This is all there is. My friends, that's our world. That's what most people believe in our time. Yet Tolkien was drawn to it because he could see it didn't pull any punches. It didn't make things come out rosy. For example, at the Battle of Ragnarok, at the end of all things, the gods themselves are killed. and the universe collapses back into the original chaos out of which it came. But Tolkien was drawn to the fact that there are kind of strange moments within that world of Germanic, Norse, and Icelandic myth of a heroism that we ought to pay attention to. He especially liked the story of Fafnir and Sigurd. Fafnir is this little tiny warrior with a tiny little sword who actually slays the dragon Sigurd. When my wife and I were in England the last time, we saw one of those early depictions. It's on our wall now. Because he began to honor a heroism that was not expected to win. And he saw, can you get it, a kind of Christian hint, a kind of Christian foretaste there in the myth of Sigurd and Fafnir. And so he became the world's leading authority on Beowulf. Any of you remember Beowulf from high school? Good, good, good. Beowulf is a story that's told from a pagan point of view about events occurring in actually the Germanic world, probably been told by people living in modern-day Denmark. And it's a very dark story. And yet it has these flashes, these moments of kind of Christian light that keep kind of going off in Beowulf. And Tolkien set himself the task to figure out what was happening. And so he finally figured it out. This is crucial. He said Beowulf was probably written by Christian monks who wanted to honor the ancient pagan world and all of its excellence, but to show also what's missing by quietly imbuing that pagan story with Christian concerns. If I could put in a single sentence what Tolkien does in The Hobbit and in The Lord of the Rings, it's just that exactly. Remember, they're pre-Christian books. Don't look for a Christ in Tolkien. You know, if you don't figure out who Aslan is in the Narnia Chronicle, you might want to have an IQ check. I mean, it's so obvious. Aslan is the Christ of Narnia. Gandalf is not the Christ of Middle-earth. We'll see later why that's the case. And so he began as a young Oxford student of age 20 to set about writing a huge retelling of the whole cosmic story from creation to consummation in new mythic terms that would honor the pagan past but show at the same time how Christianity gradually emerged, came into that world, and redeemed it. When he died at age 81, he was still working on it. From age 19 or 20 until 81, he worked on it. It now comprises 12 fat volumes called The History of the Peoples of Middle-earth. The day on which Tolkien reached 21, he got on the phone immediately and called Edith Bratt. Have you forgotten me? She said, yeah, I'm engaged. Sorry. Tolkien said, no, you're not. I'm coming to see you. He did, and of course you know what happened. They fell in love all over again. She broke off her engagement to the other fellow. They were married just as he shipped out to the horrors of World War I. They were to have, as I said, 4 children. It's been my enormous privilege to have met one of them, Priscilla. They had 3 sons and a daughter. When my wife and I were in London during the year 1987 and 88, I hit upon the idea of just writing Priscilla Tolkien to see if she might be willing to talk for 30 minutes about her father's work to this American egghead. She said, sure, come on out. Well, I promised her I wouldn't stay more than a half hour. When I got there, I discovered that she had prepared for me British tea. Now, British tea does not mean a cup of Lipton, please. It means an early afternoon, 4 o'clock, light supper. Cucumber sandwiches. Wonderful what they call biscuits that appear in The Hobbit, which are cookies. But above all, scones. If you haven't had scones, please go find you a scone. Scones covered with strawberries, and on top of the strawberries, what the British so honestly call full fat cream. Scrumptious. We talked for 2.5 hours. She looks like a hobbit, by the way. She's still living. I saw her in England in 2005. She's about 5 feet tall, and she has a nice paunch. You know, the hobbits don't believe in dieting. That's a stupid American idea. And she welcomed me into her home. She said several interesting things about her father. She said, none of us had any idea we were growing up in the home of somebody who's going to become world famous. Our father was just another Oxford professor like everybody else. She said there were several interesting things about him, however. One was that though he was a Tory, i.e. on the right wing politically, he was also, by the way, a monarchist. Tolkien did not like democracy. He wanted a return of monarchy. She said he was the single kindest and most supportive Oxford professor for all of the workers, the daily workers at Oxford. He looked out for the little man when everybody was talking big ideas about political matters and economic matters. Tolkien was caring for the little people. But then she shocked me. She said, and he was determined that I had the same education as my brothers. I would have no inferior education because I was a woman. On the contrary. Then she said, you know, my father would have had much use for you. My goodness, that gave me a shock. I said, why? She said, because you're a Baptist. And then she told me the story, the sad story, of course, of the Tolkiens having snubbed her as Baptist and how he grew up with a kind of prejudice against my kind, your kind, some of you. But she said, then what was most remarkable is when my father sat down to do his creative work, all of that fell away. All of that anger, all of that bitterness, all of that sadness about his not having a father, having lost his mother, that fell away. And he delved to the very depths of the Christian faith. Tolkien was a huge success at Oxford. He was made a full professor at age 32. I mean, that just doesn't happen, please. C.S. Lewis never was made a professor at Oxford. Incredible. Partly because of such prejudice against him as a Christian. But Tolkien was the most brilliant philologist, student of languages at Oxford. As I told you, he knew 14 languages, almost all of them dead. He helped edit the Oxford English Dictionary, brilliant contributions to it. But he was a mediocre lecturer. He was not very good. You could find him talking on YouTube, and I dare you to understand him without looking at the subscripts. You can't. It's unintelligible. Unintelligible. However, W.H. Auden said when he was Tolkien's student, when Tolkien read Beowulf in Anglo-Saxon, it was as if Gandalf were reading Beowulf. C.S. Lewis was to say of Tolkien, almost every one of us use language for our purposes of communication and the like. Tolkien was inside language. He didn't use language. He lived language. For Tolkien, therefore, we'll be seeing this in a minute, words and language are the most important gifts we have. There's great debate over what it means to be created in the image of God. For Tolkien, what it means to be bearers of the divine image is that we can speak, communicate, have words, to build whole worlds with. Remember that the key phrase in the Gospel of John 1, in arche angelo logos, in the beginning was the Word. So for Tolkien, words are sacred, words are revelatory. Hobbitla just comes into his mind. One quick example. He said language has gotten increasingly less able to communicate as it's become more abstract and more technical and more scientific. Are you aware that every word I have just uttered once contained a metaphor that everybody could recognize? The easy way of teaching this lesson is to look at all of the Italian pastas. Are you aware those are all metaphors? Spaghetti means string. Farfalla means butterfly. Pasta itself means glue, which is what it's like. Vermicelli means little worms. That's what vermicelli looks like. The example Tolkien liked was these three words, pneuma, P-N-E-U-M-A, as in the word pneumatic tube, as in the word pneumonia, linked with the Latin word spiritus, S-P-I-R-I-T-U-S, with the Hebrew word ruach, R-U-A-C-H. He said all of three of those words in their original meaning, when you utter them, meant wind, breath, spirit, at one and the same time. Wind, breath, spirit, at one and the same time. We know that pneumonia is a disease of the wind, of the chest, the lungs. But we, of course, also know that it's an image of the wind that blows. And as such, it can't be controlled. The spirit bloweth where it listeth, says the King James, blows where it wants. So it's wind, it's breath, it's spirit together. For us, we have to say first breath, then wind, then spirit. So he then, with the success of The Hobbit in 1938, received a visit from Rainer Unwin, the publisher in Oxford. Unwin makes a trip to Oxford, and the publisher in London, makes a trip from London to Oxford and says, Tolkien, this book is such a hit, we've got to publish more. Do you have any more? No problem, he says, let me go upstairs and get it. So up the stairs he goes to his workroom, where, by the way, he worked sitting cross-legged in a bed, with all of his notes spread around him, going through the successive drafts of all of his work, two-fingered. It's what I call the biblical method, seek and ye shall find. Yeah, boom, boom. Draft after draft after draft. I've got it, he said, brought down a big, huge sheaf of what we now know as the Silmarillion. Unwin began to read and said, oh my God, this is like reading the phone book in Elvish. You know, names, dates, chronicles, events. We want more hobbits. And so Tolkien set himself the task in 1939 of trying to introduce these little creatures, who we talked about in the book we'll discuss in a moment, into this vast cosmic story that he called his legendarium. He worked at it for 15 years. 1939 to 1954. He became enormously discouraged. He gave up over and again. He thought, of course, Oxford during the Blitz, that Oxford would be bombed into smithereens, that his manuscripts would all go up in fire and smoke. The one person who would not let Tolkien quit was his best friend, C.S. Lewis. And so when Lewis died, Tolkien wrote a poignant obituary for the Times of London. He said, I feel like a man who's like a tree whose root has been struck with an axe. Of course, you know, the tap root is the life root. Tolkien taught at Oxford, became a a world celebrity, much against his desire. He discovered that Americans would find where he was living and would come to the picture window in their house with their cameras, you know, aimed in at Tolkien and his folks sitting around the table. And he was also a man of great humor. He once, on Halloween, dressed up as a Viking, helmet and all, and scared the you-know-what out of all the kids in Oxford because he looked like a real Viking. He learned to swim down the Isis that flows through Oxford on his back, wearing a bowler hat and smoking a pipe. But the best thing Tolkien did was, I think the funniest, was to carry with him extra set of false teeth. As if you've been to Britain, you know they have a very interesting means of exchange. When you and I go to a cashier, we deal out the money and give the cashier our whatever we're paying for. In Britain, you pull out of your pocket the things you have there, and the cashier then takes them from your hand. Well, he would pull out his pockets with a set of false teeth. And, of course, the cashier didn't know what on earth to make of that. He, at the end of his life, saw that his wife, Edith Bratt, had sacrificed her life for his. And so, while she never really very deeply understood what her husband's work was about, he said, "She gave herself for me. Now it's time for me to give myself to her." And so they moved to a coastal town where he had no friends, didn't know anybody, and was bored to death. But he said, "No, I wanted to honor her." And so he dies in 1973. And we're here tonight because of him. So, questions, please. Right over here is one.
Get that.
Should be about Tolkien, the man. We're going to come to The Hobbit in a minute.
Okay. My question concerns Tolkien, the absence of his father. How do you think that affected his view of God?
Good question. Let me back it up a step, however, by saying that one reason Tolkien and Lewis were drawn so closely together, they lost their mothers at the same age. Mabel Tolkien dies in 1900. He's 8. Lewis's mother dies when he's 10. And for both of them, it's an overwhelmingly wretching event. They never got over it. Never got over it. In fact, Humphrey Carpenter said from the day of his mother's death, Tolkien developed a fundamentally pessimistic view of the world. That he has a deep sense of things finally ending in doom, were the major words of Lord of the Rings. I don't like to psychoanalyze Tolkien to say losing his father affected his idea of God. What, you have anything in mind in particular?
Well, I guess I was just curious about his view of God in general, how it came out in his books that he wrote.
But can you see yourself anything that would say not having a biological father at home, he would have seen God thus and so?
Yeah, I guess that's what I'm asking.
Yeah, I don't see anything that made him other than just a really orthodox Christian. Yeah. Over here, please.
Did he remain Roman Catholic?
Yes. Did you all hear the question? Did Tolkien remain a permanent Catholic? In fact, his Catholicism became more intense with the years. I have to be honest, he didn't like Vatican II. He did not like the vernacular Mass. Not because he feared that the Mass might be understandable to the masses, but because he thought the Latin Mass made the Catholic Church truly Catholic in the lowercase, universal. You could go to Mass at any place in Uganda, any place in London, any place in San Francisco, and hear the same act performed. There are Catholic moments in Lord of the Rings, in fact. Though again, not to get them doesn't bother him a bit. Let's be very clear about that. One of the big disagreements Lewis and Tolkien had was over the purpose of their art. Lewis said, everything I do is for the sake of evangelism. I want to write in order that others might be converted. Tolkien did not. Tolkien felt that art has its own integrity. And therefore, an artist's first aim is to his or her craft, to making that thing really of the highest order, so that form and matter become inseparable. He said, in fact, if my work has to be propped up on Christian stilts, it deserves to fall. And that's because I think of his Catholicism. He says the church is the place where conversion occurs. Now, sure, there are means outside the church, but it's the church that does the work of the apostolate for him. And so he said, I couldn't imagine Galadriel without my devotion to the Virgin Mary. When he could, he attended Mass daily. A lot of my Protestant students at Baylor and before at Wake Forest therefore can't get Lambos. You all get Lambos? Lambos is the elven food in The Lord of the Rings. We don't get it in The Hobbit. Elven food is very light, thin, airy. It has no power to satisfy the stomach's hunger, but it fortifies the will, strengthens the soul, gives courage. So I ask my students, what's that? That's the sacrament, of course. That's the consecrated bread. When Boromir dies, you know, Boromir is the one who betrays the company from within. It's very important that the real danger that the company runs into is not from outsiders, but from one within, a traitor. Not Judas, by the way. Boromir would not be Judas. How would he not be Judas? Judas, of course, goes and hangs himself or jumps off a cliff. Boromir is Peter. He is the noblest warrior among the hobbits, the one who has courage in such huge amounts that he is not afraid to take on Sauron. But, of course, lacking the wisdom to see that if he wore the ring, he would be the new Sauron. And so he breaks the company, and yet he dies redeemed. Because Aragorn, the rightfully returning king, enacts the office of priest. He shrives Boromir by the three acts which go into what's called the sacrament of reconciliation now, once called the sacrament of penance. One, contritio cordis, deep sorrow of heart. Two, confessio oris, confession of the mouth, verbal open. And finally, satisfactio operis, deeds done to show that this penance was serious. He says, I tried to take the ring from Frodo. Confession of the mouth. But I am utterly sorry. Sad as of heart. But I killed all the orcs I could that Sam and Frodo might go free. Satisfactio operis. So deeply Catholic moments. But if you don't get them, that doesn't bother Tolkien a minute. Good?
Can you speak for a moment what it was like to be the feeling of minority, I think, for early 20th century Roman Catholic author in Britain, especially considering the minority of Roman Catholicism? You alluded to that a little bit. Can you speak more to that?
Sure. Well, Roman Catholicism, while it has been a historically minority kind of Christianity within Britain, has not been a minority kind of literary phenomenon. In my view, the greatest poet of the 19th century is Gerard Manley Hopkins, a very devout Roman Catholic convert. Among the greatest poets of the 20th century are T.S. Eliot, an Anglo-Catholic, W.H. Auden, an Anglo-Catholic. So I don't think Tolkien felt himself a minority as a writer as much as a professing Catholic. For example, he's buried in the most obscure place in Oxford. It's hard to find his grave. It's in a little place called Wolvercote, where he's buried among Polish emigres, the least likely place for a world historical figure, and his gravestone's just the size of everybody else's. So he was more isolated as a professing Catholic than as a Catholic writer. Very good.
You mentioned that behind Boromir there was a picture of Peter, and I was wondering if you could perhaps fill me in if there were any other pictures.
That was the last thing, and if...
If you could just fill me in, were there any other pictures that Tolkien wrote behind his other characters? Was he trying to bring across specific meaning?
No. In fact, let's get very clear. Thank you, sir. That's a good question. Tolkien says, I cordially despise allegory. That is to say, one-to-one correspondences. He says allegories coerce the reader's freedom of imagination. So the Bible doesn't have allegories. The Bible has types and antitypes. Adam is the type of Christ. But he's not the allegory of Christ, you follow? It's in him that the whole race starts over again, is reborn. So he said, when people said, oh, the ring must be the atomic bomb. No. It's horrible, but it's not the atomic bomb. Or someone said, oh, it's the ring in Wagner's opera. He said, the rings in Wagner's opera resemble the chief ring of Sauron in being round. So, no, there are no allegories. Now, there are resemblances. He says, I like historical applications. Sure. So, I was kind of offer a historical application, but not an allegory. But thank you. Good question.
Quick question. How did C.S. Lewis and Tolkien meet? And another question. When he went off to World War I, I'm just curious, what type of unit was he in? Infantry, artillery, or do you know that?
Okay. Could you hear the question? The question is about, as I gather it, the basic impact that they both underwent as a result of World War I. It couldn't be more different. For reasons that I could explain later, but not now, Lewis remained largely unaffected by his experience in the war, though he was wounded by so-called friendly fire, where heaving artillery forward, it fell short among British soldiers, and Lewis was wounded. But you never get warfare of the kind in Lewis that you get in Tolkien. Tolkien was marked to the core of his being. He fought at the Battle of the Somme. Perhaps, well, not necessary, but one of the worst, costliest, and most useless battles of World War I. He came to see that World War I marked what His Holiness John Paul II would call the culture of death, where for the first time in human history, the most civilized cultures begin to go at each other's throats and killing every living thing, wiping even the land itself clear. Tolkien was attending a reunion of what the British call the old boys at his school in Birmingham, King Edward's. He looked out and saw all the empty places that should have been filled by his friends who have been killed in World War I. If you go to Oxford, every college has a huge scroll, not of World War II dead, but of World War I dead. He had not yet written the scene called The Passage Through the Dead Marshes. Anybody recall that passage in Lord of the Rings? One of the most horrible passages, where they are treading over corpses that lie beneath the frozen marsh. When Tolkien came out over the top of his trench, he was in trench warfare, he was stepping on the faces of his friends who were lying in the frozen mud at the Somme. It left him believing that war is the scourge of the modern world. It's the essential characteristic of our time. A couple more, then we need to move on. Thank you for standing, sir, and delivering.
You spoke of this huge world that Tolkien created over many decades that must have inspired thousands of pages of notes and so forth. I'm wondering how much of that has been published and how much beyond The Hobbit and The Lord of the Rings is really accurate or added to by other writers.
Good, good. The question is, given the fact that Tolkien was writing from age 19 until age 81, how much of it has been published and how much of what we have is accurate? First of all, The Lord of the Rings is utterly accurate. I mean, he lives to see it published. So he edits it over and again until he gets it right. Tolkien was such a perfectionist, he never published much. He wouldn't let it go. When people would try to grab manuscripts out of his hand, he wouldn't let it go. He'd keep writing and rewriting. So The Lord of the Rings has a half a dozen appendices. The reconstructed history of the peoples of Middle-earth, the 12 volumes, are the work of his son Christopher, who's now in his 80s, still living, unbelievable, late 80s, whom we have to trust, because he would find repeated revisions of every single scene, and he would weave together the best of what he thought those scenes to be. So those books are, as it were, edited, but not Lord of the Rings. But I think there's nothing else. I think, there's one thing else. Unbelievable. And that is, about 5 years ago, an American professor was knocking around in the Bodleian, that's the great library at Oxford, and came upon a dusty cardboard box that had not been opened and was unlabeled. You have to know a little bit of background to see what happens. Tolkien was asked over and again, look, you are the great master of Beowulf. You've got to translate Beowulf. You are inside Old English. Tolkien said, it's the perfect poem. I wouldn't touch it. Never. They opened the box, professor from Syracuse, and there is Tolkien's fully annotated translation of Beowulf. It hasn't yet been published because, unfortunately, the Tolkien heirs are a bunch of golems. I'm serious. They're so greedy fighting over property and money rights. That's why Peter Jackson has had to wait 10 years to do the Hobbit movies, squabbling over money. But, yeah, well, there's one thing yet to come. One more, and then there's a lady. It's back here at the back.
I know that he loves trees, and that one of his favorite trees was at the...
A bit louder now. He loved trees, and that...
And one of his favorite trees was at the Oxford Botanic Gardens, and he named that tree Laocoon. Now, what does Laocoon mean, and what was the reason why he loved trees so much?
Actually, that's a detail I didn't know. Laocoon is a very famous Greek sculpture. But yes, this is important. Tolkien thought trees were sacred in the following sense. Now, he's not a tree hugger, don't get me wrong. But Tolkien thought that trees have life patterns that are more like human beings than any other botanical creation. You know, our kind comes to its maturity very slowly. I remember we adopted cats who were 5 days old, and 2 weeks they were kittens, and 2 more weeks they were cats. Babies have to be very gradually humanized, and of course we don't finish growing morally and spiritually until the end. Trees, therefore, represent longevity for Tolkien. They represent shade for Tolkien. They resupply the air with oxygen. They go through such wonderful transitions to give the world enormous beauty that Tolkien simply liked to be with trees. So he was a terrible walker. He and Lewis would go on walks, and Lewis would give up because Tolkien would find a tree and sit, say, I want to sit here for a while. And Lewis would, of course, be walking on. By the way, he thought the noblest of all animals, you want to take a guess? The noblest of all animals? No one willing to guess? I can't hear, so you have to tell me. Raise your hand. Raise your hand. Tell me where a giraffe appears in Tolkien. The horse, yes. Yes, to him, horses are, of course, beautiful. Their motion has a fluidity that's poetic. He names his horses very carefully. Remember, Sam's pony is named just plain Bill. Whereas Gandalf's horse is named Shadowfax, which means makes shadows. He moves so quickly. As I was saying to Linda Randall, their horse people, horses are unique also in giving themselves over to human companionship. There are other equine animals, so I'm told, that will not submit to being ridden. Zebras, I've been told zebras cannot be tamed. But horses give themselves to us. They become our companions, our friends, and let us ride them, in some sense, master them. So he thought they were the noblest. Okay, shall we move on to a bit of The Hobbit? I thought I'd begin by talking about some of the Hobbit qualities with the following proviso. Many people think that artists, writers, musicians, painters, sculptors, dramatists, poets, are people who just sit down and let their fingers fly. You know, anybody can be a writer. Come on. Doesn't take any work to do that. Please. As much hard thinking goes into making a great work of art as goes into designing the most complex problem in nuclear physics. Hard, hard thinking. Not thinking of an imaginative kind, thinking in images, not thinking in numbers and abstractions. So I want us to ask the question, why would Tolkien create these little creatures called hobbits? When the world that produced him, the great heroic world of the North, cared only about giants, big behemoths, Beorns, for example, we meet in The Hobbit. Why would he give them characteristics such as the following? First of all, that they're little, that they're small. Think about the way our world worships size. Where most of us are taller and larger than our parents. Where most sports are dominated by people of great size. Where bigness is everything. By contrast, for Tolkien, smallness is everything. It's the little people of the world who really matter. And little not only in stature, maybe not even primarily in stature, but people whom the world doesn't notice. Think of the women tonight in the nursing homes of Plyler, Texas, changing the diapers and bedpans of people who don't know who they are, who don't know that they are. There are the real heroes of our world, totally unnoticed, totally unhonored, totally underpaid. So it isn't just smallness of stature that matters for the hobbits, though it is that. They're overlooked. They're disregarded. For example, if you know in the Lord of the Rings, Saruman can't believe that Gandalf takes these people seriously. Come on, he said, leave your little friends behind. They just get in the way. First principle in smallness. Secondly, they are omnivores. They like to eat. As I tell my students, there's no slim fast in all of Hobbiton. People don't diet in Tolkien. They, you don't know how many times? 6 times a day. Now, there's a real hero for you. They love food. They are of the earth, earthy, as the psalmist says. They are people thoroughly ensconced in the good gifts of God's good creation. Thirdly, they are walkers. They have large, somewhat hairy feet, and they can really walk long distances at great endurance. Think of how that contrasts with our world. We now take the air. We now take the bus. We now take the car. Tolkien stopped driving an automobile when he saw what they had done to the rural countryside of England, how the great highways had ruined rural England. He stopped driving. So he wants to honor things that move slowly, that don't happen quickly. And the hobbits are among those, therefore, who are walkers. They are also homebodies. The hobbits don't abide by the American notion of trying to get away from it all, of striking out for the territories like Huck Finn, of getting in your Airstream trailer and traveling off to California, as Walker Percy says, to meet other people in their Airstream trailers and to talk about what? Your Airstream trailers. They have no written laws, no formal code of justice, because they all trust each other. One way Tolkien is trying to recover our sense of language is that the only law officers in the Shire are the sheriffs, or sheriffs, or what we would call, of course, sheriffs. So our word sheriff comes from those who once kept the boundaries of the Shire, the British word for county. And therefore, they defend their own small local territory. They have no grandiose visions of saving the world. You know, liberty, equality, fraternity, those would never be words that would enter a hobbit's mind. Does anyone know what happens in the great battle scenes of The Lord of the Rings, what they shout? The Shire! The Shire! That's like shouting, Chandler! Brownsboro, Murchison, Powell, I mean, you know. They have no grandiose ambitions. They don't think too highly of themselves. They think very lowly of themselves, in fact. But they have a hidden courage. When threatened, they will respond with remarkable resilience. And another quality I noticed in reading The Hobbit was that they love maps. Never had occurred to me why they love maps. When my brother-in-law and my sister-in-law came to visit us in London, the first place we went was the map store. Well, there are particular reasons for that. But for Tolkien, we must honor all great human achievements. And think what it was to map Wood County, Texas, with nobody able to view it from the air. I mean, that's an incredible accomplishment, to map the whole world by means of sheer human ingenuity. I mean, the astrolabe is one thing, sure, but maps, in a certain sense, reveal the way human beings are at home in the world, but are not animals. Animals don't have maps, don't read maps, but have a certain kind of modest mastery over the world. However, the hobbits have one major problem. When I ask my students, what is that major problem, they say, can't think of any. And I say, that's their problem. Their problem is they have no problems. To have no problems is to be a problem, is to be in very great trouble. Can you see why? To have no problems is to begin to live presumptuously, is to begin to live complacently. It is to live as if to say nothing will ever go wrong. Nothing ever bad will happen. There's a Russian proverb that goes like this. We begin to grow up when we stop saying, it won't happen to me. It will. The hobbits have not yet discovered that. So their world is too snug, too comfy. It's too much secured by artificial means. That is to say, they've been protected by others from around them and have come, therefore, to undervalue the way in which their lives are indeed protected lives. I submit to you that's exactly our condition prior to 2001. 9/11 was a shock to us, among many other reasons, because we lived under assumptions not unlike that. It can't happen here. It will only happen there. So let's look to see how it happens with the hobbits and what could be done about it. The first thing to be noticed about what the hobbits do to develop means of resisting the huge problem that they have. In this case, it's a problem that they've had to adopt. That is, the dwarves, as you know, have had their gold stolen by Smaug. And Smaug's realm, by the way, the Lonely Mountain, is indeed engulfed with what we would call S-M-O-G. And so back to our young man, Tolkien is not saying his name resembles S-M-O-G. That word develops after Tolkien has written. So, again, no allegory there. Smaug the dragon has taken the gold of the dwarves, and they ask Bilbo to help them recover it. So Bilbo, who's lived a life without problems, agrees to take on the dwarf problem. But what's interesting, as I reread the novel this week, is the way he agrees to take on the dwarves' problem. Let me read to you a passage that struck me with special force. It's very early in the novel. It's page 33 in my edition. See if you can hear what's going on in this early passage. Can't turn pages and drink water at the same time. See if you can hear, again, resonances, echoes, vibrations. Not one-to-one correspondences, but listen to what Bilbo says about himself. Make sure I have the right. Yes, here it was. He, after being invited to join the dwarves, discovers that they've left early, and that he's been left behind, and that therefore he's either going to stay there in the Shire, in Hobbiton, in his nice snug little tunnel, or perhaps he'll go and try to catch up. Listen to what he says. To the end of his days, this is the narrator, Bilbo could never remember how he found himself outside his hobbit hole, without a hat, without a walking stick, without any money, or anything that he usually took when he went out, leaving his second breakfast, by the way, I just have second breakfast, leaving his second breakfast half finished and quite unwashed up, pushing his keys into Gandalf's hands and running as fast as his furry feet could carry him down the lane, past the great mill, across the water, and then on for a mile or more. Notice, he could never remember how he listened to the passive, reflexive voice, how he found himself outside. This is one of the most fundamental qualities of Tolkien. All of the important events in Tolkien are not things people volunteer for. They don't raise their hands and say, "Hey, I'll do it." They find themselves swept up into this larger reality. They find themselves, to use overt Christian language, called, summoned. They discover that they have what Tolkien calls, using good medieval language, an errand. Remember what a knight errant is. A knight errant is one who goes out on a mission. They find that they have a quest, that they have a calling, that they are summoned by something from beyond themselves that doesn't really ask them to volunteer, but sweeps them up in it. I submit that's one of Tolkien's profoundest Christian observations. The deepest Christian things are about the way in which we are called by God in such a way as to follow almost unconsciously. Remember, our Lord says in John's Gospel, "You did not choose me. I chose you." And Frodo says over again, "Why was I chosen? Why was I chosen? I didn't want to go. This is not what I am." But he goes. He's called. He's summoned. He answers. But notice, no sooner does Bilbo discover that he's been swept up, he's going to go off and catch up with these dwarves, than he regrets it. He wishes he hadn't done it. And so half of the book is like this. He said, at this very next page, "To think it will soon be June," grumbled Bilbo as he splashed along behind the others in a very muddy track. "It was after tea time." Remember, that's what I went to with Priscilla Tolkien. "It was pouring with rain and had been all day. His hood was dripping into his eyes. His cloak was full of water. The pony was tired and stumbled on stones. The others were too grumpy to talk to." And he says, "And I'm sure the rain has got into the dry clothes and into the food bags," thought Bilbo. "Bother burgling." He's meant to be a robber, go back to get the gold. "Bother burgling." And "bother" is an actual swear word. "Damn burgling. And everything to do with it. I wish I was at home in my nice hole by the fire with the kettle just beginning to sing." It wasn't the last time he wished that. So for Tolkien, every person in this room has a calling, a summons. The word vocation means calling, vocare in Latin. Everybody here has an errand, a mission, a quest. Notice the word quest contains within it the very root for our same word question. It's always going to be something dubious, full of doubt, making us wonder if we did the right thing. And above all, it's going to be dangerous. Always dangerous. See, the problem with the hobbits, nothing is dangerous in Hobbiton. Bilbo goes out from Hobbiton and discovers that the most important things in life are dangerous. Can you name one that's not? I got to thinking on the way down here, I can't name one. And I'm not talking about physical danger only, or even primarily, but spiritual danger, moral danger. Friendship is a dangerous thing. You will be asked to stand up for your friends when nobody else stands up for them, and at your cost if you do. Marriage is a very dangerous thing. No wonder that more than 50% of all marriages fail in America, and the evangelical rate is higher than the national rate. Having children may be the most dangerous thing of all. Tolkien is trying to say, you better have a calling, a summons. It doesn't mean a trade. It doesn't mean being a CEO. It doesn't mean being a professor. It means a life summons to give yourself away. And that's what Bilbo learns to do. Second quality that Bilbo helps us see is characteristic of the life Tolkien describes is a very strange one. And that is a sense that the world is ultimately ordered, though it doesn't look like it. The world looks like a great chaos. Everything seems to be just a jumble. Nothing seems to be going anywhere. Everything seems to be running amok. Witness the recent campaign. Witness the events after 2011. But notice the kind of comfort that Tolkien gives us. He doesn't use what is to me the tritest phrase in the English language. Everything has a reason. I can't think of a worse phrase. I have a good Christian psychiatrist friend who says, that's right. So let's come in here and try to find out what the reason is. Listen to what Bilbo says. This is in chapter 4 called Riddles in the Dark. Where the central event of the whole book occurs almost without our even knowing it. He's crawling in the tunnel of the trolls. His head was swimming. He guessed as well as he could and crawled for a good way, till suddenly his hand met what felt like a tiny ring of coal metal lying on the floor in the tunnel. It was the turning point in his career, but he didn't know it. Every person in this room has met a turning point in their lives, and we didn't know it until later. St. Augustine says, our lives look like chicken tracks as we live them. So when we look back upon them with a providential view, that we can see the order amidst the chicken tracks. He put the ring in his pocket almost without thinking. Notice, he could not think what to do, nor could he think what had happened, or why he had been left behind, or why, if he had been left behind, the goblins had not caught him, or even why his head was so sore. He'd been bumping it on the roof of the tunnel. The truth was he had been lying quiet, out of sight, out of mind, in a very dark corner for a long while. And then he begins to add very strange language. Listen to this. As Bilbo is trying to escape from Gollum, the narrator says, Bilbo was saved by pure luck. For that, of course, was the answer. Now, Tolkien, the narrator, says, that, of course, was the answer. He was saved by pure luck. The word luck, as I reread this story, appears over and over and over and over again. Because Tolkien believes luck is a hugely important force in the world. There are people who simply have bad luck. Let's be honest. No fault of their own. They get dealt a hand of cards they didn't ask for. Tolkien uses an old English word to describe luck. It's called weird. Isn't that good? Weird. W-Y-R-D. But gradually, Tolkien shows how that Anglo-Saxon word that meant luck came to mean providence, order, divine order. So for him, the question is, what do we do with our luck? What do we do with the fact that the world is full of chance? That the world is full of accidents? That the world is full of things that we cannot plan in advance for and would do worse if we could? And Tolkien gives us some hints of what to do about that. The basic one of which is to know that there are more forces at work than just one. While luck and chance are real, the larger reality is providence. Bilbo was intended to find the ring. He thought he found it by mere luck. And that's true. But he found it because some other larger providential power was there. The thing that messes people up in Tolkien more than any other, and I am coming to a quick halt, is what led the dwarves to be so angry about Smaug in the first place. They had their gold stolen. Now, in one sense, they want to get justice back. They had been unfairly robbed and ruined. But notice they also want to get revenge on Smaug. To use biblical language, they want to return evil for evil. And what is worse, they want yet more gold so that when they get their gold hoard back and Smaug is killed, they will be able to get even more. That's what ruined Gollum. Gollum was the first to get the ring by slaying his brother, Cain and Abel-like. And then he kept the ring for 500 years. And by the way, Peter Jackson has really got Gollum down. Are you aware that Andy Serkis's circus voice and movements are his, but everything else is digital? The digitally realized Gollum is more frightening and pathetic than any merely humanly acted Gollum could be. His name derives from the Latin word gula, which means throat. It's the basis for our word gluttony. And Gollum is a glutton for, thank God, something that didn't do great damage, raw fish. You remember, he loves to bite into a good, juicy, freshly caught raw fish. But he's been thereby cut off from all fellowship. He therefore talks to himself all the time. Gollum, 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 Gollum. He's a throat mutterer. He is so starved for community, he has to create a false community with himself, talking to himself. Because Dorothy Sayers says the nearest thing to gluttony in our time is our mania for possessions, our greed, our cupidity, our avarice. We all want more and more and more. When Dante came to write the Divine Comedy, he spread this whole catalog of sins all over the place. But he said the single sin that undoes more people than any other is greed. Or put it in American terms, shopping. I have things that I know I own but can't find. That's because I own too much stuff. Teresa of Avila said, I thank God for all the things I don't own. Well, greed, cupidity, avarice is what undoes the dwarves and what Bilbo temporarily helps them overcome as they fall right back into it. When he gets back home, he discovers his home is being auctioned off by the greediest people in Hobbiton, the Sackville Bagginses. How's that for a snooty name? But here's the single answer that Tolkien proposes more deeply than any others, and I will quit with this. Once Bilbo discovers that by putting on the ring, he can disappear, he is able at last to escape Gollum. And of course, Gollum is furious when he finds out that Bilbo, in fact, has the ring. And Bilbo has the chance to kill him. He could have killed him. Some might argue he should have killed him. In fact, Frodo argues in The Lord of the Rings, he deserved death. To which Gandalf replies in a crucial response. Deserves death? I dare say he does. Many deserve death who do not get it. Anyone want to take an estimate in this room about how many? Everybody. If anyone got what he or she deserved, it would be death. Then he says, and some get death who don't deserve it. You want to think of anybody there? One, supremely. That's right. Again, Tolkien, very quietly. Instead, Bilbo had pity on him. He had pity on him. He saw that Gollum's condition was so wretched of his own doing that the only hope for Gollum would be to pity him. Now, pity is a word that derives from the Latin pietas. Pietas is a Latin word that covers a lot of ground. It means a deep sense of gratitude for everything we have been given. You know, St. Paul says, what do we have that has not been given to us? And so he has, remember the Pietà of Michelangelo? That's why it's called it. Mercy, pity, that sculpture cries out. There's Tolkien the Christian. Because remember, in the ancient world, to have pity upon the undeserving was an act of injustice. If you forgave somebody who had done an egregious evil, you yourself were evil. You had not given them their due. And so can you see how the Christian faith revolutionized that pagan world? By saying that's the heart of our faith. We precisely forgive those who are unworthy of forgiveness because we ourselves are most supremely unworthy. My wife says I've never given a speech that was too short. And so I'll end with that. And by the way, if you need to leave, please have no fear of doing so.
You've hinted that there's very little allegory, if any allegory, in Tolkien, and yet you've done deep, deep exegesis on the meanings of the philologist's words.
Mm-hmm.
Would you say the closest, I never thought about this, but the closest you come to allegory is the meaning of his words then? Because there seems to be
allegory,
deeper.
Yes, yes. If you want to call that allegory, for example, this is very helpful. Gandalf is a wizard. Now, wizard for us means magician. And then Gandalf has certain magical powers. However, Gandalf practices white magic, not black magic. White magic is magic that derives from a carefully crafted skill. In his case, the skill of making fire and fireworks and light. But the word wizard is rooted in the Anglo-Saxon word wis, W-Y-S, from which our word wise comes from. So yes, Gandalf is profoundly wise, wizard. So he's tried to set off echoes in our minds that will help us see what lies behind a word we've largely lost the meaning of. So if you want to call that allegory, okay. But yeah, that's where he wants to retrieve the power of words that we have now largely lost. For example, one more. The word Frodo's sword. Anybody know what Frodo's sword is named? Yes, sir.
Sting.
Well, it is short. It appears to be no more than 12 or 14 inches, befitting a hobbit. But it troubled me for a long time as a child in East Texas, hearing St. Paul's words, where he cries out, O death, where is thy sting? Well, mosquitoes sting. When you get an injection, you get a pinprick. That's a sting. So I went to the dictionary and discovered that the word sting is from the Old English stengan, S-T-E-N-G-A-N, which means a sword thrust unto death. You with me? So sting, death, sword thrust, anguish, suffering. Yeah. Or the word wraith. We have the ring wraiths, these awful creatures who've possessed the nine rings of men so long. They no longer have bodies. They've been eaten up. They're just ghost spirits. But the word wraith comes from the Anglo-Saxon rithan, W-R-I-T-H-A-N, thorn, A-N. Because wraith means, on the one hand, to be twisted, as in when we create a Christmas wreath, It's woven together to a twisted form. It also means smoke-like. We speak of a wraith, something so thin as to be seen between it. But it also, therefore, means ghost. So wraith means twisted, inwardly turned, smoke-like anger. It's the root of the word wrath as well. So the ring wraiths or ring wraths. Yeah, good.
For many of us, I'm sure we can remember the first time that we read The Hobbit or The Lord of the Rings, and maybe the second and the third and fourth for me. But I'd like to know how did you come into contact with Tolkien's writings, and how mm-hmm. did you decide to invest so much of your life
Thank
and your
you.
Career?
Thank you. Could you hear him? The question is, how did this one person come into the Tolkienian world? Well, it began in 1965 when I was a graduate student at the University of Chicago, and Tolkien was published in paperback for the first time. So everybody was reading Tolkien in 1965. You would see restroom signs that read, Frodo Lives, for example. Or you'd find that said, J.R.R. Tolkien is hobbit-forming. So you couldn't be a graduate student and not know Tolkien. However, sir, your question is especially apt. When I began my teaching career in 1971 at Wake Forest, I thought my purpose was to wipe the grins off fundamentalist faces. Until I discovered I had a major problem, there were no fundamentalists. These were kids who had been formed by the 60s. They were secularists already. They didn't need to be shown the great doubters of the modern world. That's all they had. And so I tried to hit upon an idea of hooking these young 18, 19-year-olds coming out of a pagan culture, secular culture, drug culture already, 1970s. So I remembered how Tolkien had hooked me, and I decided I'll give them just the first volume, The Fellowship of the Ring, along with Flannery O'Connor, Walker Percy, C.S. Lewis, Auden, Eliot, the whole crowd. When I got to the end of the volume, they began to say, whoa, this won't work. We want all three volumes. You can't read one volume of Tolkien. So I developed a whole course called the Oxford Inklings, which I'm teaching still 40 years later at Baylor. These young people said to me two things that I'll never forget. The first thing they said, this is the largest intellectual accomplishment of my life, to have read 1,500 pages. Because ours is a world where everybody is reading 42 characters and have no power of sustained thought. They said, for the first time, I committed myself to a sustained, complex narrative that had moral and religious complications, no less than just literal plot complications. And as they said, I learned discipline for the first time. A student said to me, I learned silence for the first time. Ours is a world that despises silence. We don't dare be alone with ourselves. But then the second thing a student said to me one day after class that really hit me, he said, when I read Tolkien, I feel clean. I feel clean. Now, he meant by that not that there's no overt sex, which there is none, not that there are no overt profanity, there is none, but he meant morally clean, spiritually clean. Not that good and evil are absolute, please. Tolkien is not a dualist. If Gollum, the evil character, had not been shown mercy, the quest to destroy the ring would never have succeeded. Good and evil are always deeply, deeply interwoven. They differ by an eyelash. But he said, I feel clean because I can see where the difference is. That's my testimony. One more will go. Right here.
Dr. Wood, can we have two more? Because I have a question. Okay. And I walked over here for him, and I don't want to steal his question.
Yes, sir. So, give him the mic. Yeah, please. Thank you.
I'm going to be probably the most ignorant Tolkien fan you'll ever meet. But I've always had a real problem with Tolkien, and I'm going to be very honest with you. When I read C.S. Lewis, the clarity of salvation is so right between the eyes.
Mm-hmm.
I don't see any real clear salvation in Tolkien's work. It's wonderful mythology. It's wonderful Nordic saga. It's wonderful psychological intricacy. Mm-hmm. But I just have a hard time dealing with salvation in Tolkien.
Sure. That's a valid response, not a valid criticism. There's a distinction. A response is simply how one feels. So I point out that I can go to the blackboard in any Bader classroom and rake my fingers down and make everybody scream. They respond. You follow me? They haven't offered a critical judgment. A critical judgment depends upon bringing the right expectations to the kind of work that deserve those expectations. Tolkien is not writing a book about the Roman road to salvation. A, all have sinned and come short of the glory of God. B, believe in the Lord Jesus Christ and you shall be saved. C, confess him before men and he shall confess you before his Father who is in heaven. He's not doing that. And therefore, to expect him to do that is to bring a wrong set of expectations to Tolkien. Now, having said that, at the risk of great offense, I haven't got my paycheck yet, so I've got to be very careful here. I'm making the minimum wage, by the way. My prediction is that if there is a year 3000, another millennium, as we say in East Texas, the creek don't rise, Jesus don't come back, and Moses don't object. Tolkien will be remembered and Lewis will be forgotten for the following reason. Several years ago, my wife and I gave to a kinsman of ours, a young lady, a copy of The Hobbit. She was 8 years old. At the same time, I was teaching Tolkien in a doctoral seminar at Baylor. And I then asked someone, how can it be that I could give a work of Tolkien to an 8-year-old and be teaching Tolkien to an advanced seminar in theology and literature? To which I got the wicked answer, that's how low academic standards have sunk at Baylor. However, my serious answer was this. Once you've figured out who Aslan is, that's it. I have read The Lord of the Rings not as many times, I'm sure, as some others. There's layer after layer, depth after depth. Every time I read that book, I see new dimensions. I'll go to my grave reading Tolkien without having begun to exhaust him. And to exhaust him, not just in tracking down the obscure references, that's not what I mean, in exhausting the moral and spiritual depths that are, key term, implicitly Christian. Implicitly Christian. So if you read Tolkien looking for what is implicitly Christian rather than explicitly Christian, you'll find those things. If you don't, of course you won't. I promised another question.
Right. Dr. Wood, a number of the authors you have mentioned this evening and a number of the authors you've written about, the ones that come to mind are like Eliot, of course, Tolkien, Chesterton, Flannery O'Connor. These are all Roman Catholic authors, and even Lewis is a high church Anglican. I would like to ask, is there something in that Roman Catholic tradition that leads to the combination of language and imagination that these authors tap into that perhaps we as Protestants lack in ours?
Good. Could you all hear the question? Why has most of the major literature, certainly the English-speaking world, but more largely the art of the European-American civilizations been largely Catholic? and fairly rarely Protestant? Excellent question. With a very complex answer, which I won't, of course, try to lay out in full, but briefly this. Catholics have what we call a sacramental imagination. That is to say, for them, the central events of the life of the church center upon sacraments. A sacrament is not a symbol. A sacrament is an event. A sacrament makes something happen that would not happen otherwise. Again, many Protestants hold to this view. There are many sacramental Protestants. For example, Lutherans. Presbyterians believe in the real presence of Christ. Luther said, if Christ is not really present in the supper, don't do it. One of Calvin's followers, a great preacher from the early part of the 20th century, said, memorials are held for dead men. Christ is not a dead man. Christ is the living and reigning Lord, who therefore is present mysteriously in the communion, the Lord's Supper, the Eucharist. So that in our own Baptist church in Waco, Texas, our minister never serves the Lord's Supper, which we do often, by the way. I grew up in a church that observed the Lord's Supper once quarterly, usually on Wednesday night when nobody was there because it didn't matter. Our minister always says, often with the cup in one hand and the loaf in the other, on the night in which he was betrayed, he took bread and, having given thanks, said, hoc est corpus meum. Didn't say that, of course. He said in Aramaic, this is my body. Not like my body, similar to my body, having kinship to my body. This is my body. Luther got into such a fight with Zwingli over that issue that Luther, in his typical fashion, took out a huge, what we call, Bowie knife. Because Zwingli said, oh, that's a metaphor. Luther carved into the table the Latin word E-S-T, is. And in like manner, having taken the cup and blessed it, he says, drink you all of this, for when you do so, you signal my coming again. You see, once you view the world that way, and baptism thereby the same fashion, baptism is not something you do several times. You do once. It's the act of initiation into the body of Christ. It's an act of burial. You do it right. And resurrection. As I like to say, we Baptists kill them. We drown them. We don't take anybody's laundry. We don't wash people. They're risen up to newness of life. And therefore, when a Baylor student comes to me and starts telling me that he wants to leave behind his Christian faith, I say to him always, remember your baptism. Remember your baptism. Remember your baptism. Baptism is an indelible mark. It's like being branded with the cross. You can't go inactive in baptism. It's not like a fraternity. It's not a sorority where you can kind of get out for a while and come back in for a while. It means that Christ has his hooks in us. You see, once you view the world that way, then everything is potentially sacred. Nothing is without ultimate significance. Trees, for example. Every tree becomes a potential cross. Horses, for example. Every horse becomes a potential ass on which our Lord rode into Jerusalem. As Chesterton says, we will never get rid of the cross until we get rid of right angles. Not only that one, but look around. So you begin to see the world in such a fashion as to create music, drawing, drama. I mean, the Divine Comedy, the greatest poem ever written, was written by a man with a profoundly Catholic imagination. Now, we Protestants have done pretty well in places. Bach is a very great composer, though, of course, deeply under Luther's influence, and deeply under Luther's still very Catholic kind of Christianity. Our best architecture, I think, is the Puritan and Quaker meeting houses, Shaker meeting house, especially in New England, where in the absence of any kind of liturgical sign, light and silence become holy. I was very pleased to see when I worshiped here with you folks that your windows are not blank. You've got holy images. You are forming the imaginations of your people without their even knowing it. When at our church in Waco, the young mothers came to me and said, how can we mark the imaginations of our kids, given the horrible images they're being fed day and night on television? I said without thinking, give them the icons. The icons are the Christian art of the Eastern Church, the Church of Greece and Russia. And you will mark their imaginations. So all of our Sunday school rooms have icons. We display icons on Good Friday. We observe the 8 biblical stations of the cross in our Baptist church on Good Friday. We observe Lent by the imposition of the ashes. Dust you are, and to dust you shall return, everyone says to the next one. Last Sunday was a glorious Advent Sunday. I saw an Advent wreath. On Easter, we take down our rugged cross, made by a local church member out of cedar posts, fit for a man to be hanged on, and put up a great Celtic cross. So you've got to have actions, images, to feed the imagination for it to be made Christian. We all live out of our imaginations. None of us ever does an evil deed without imagining it first, nor a good one. And I had better shut up. Thank you very much.
Thank you for already thanking him, but I also want to thank you all for your attendance here tonight and for your kind attention to all of this. I do want to point out a couple of things as we close up here. First off is that Dr. Wood's lectures are going to be available online. If you go to sylvaniachurch.com in a couple of weeks, they will show up there so you can listen to them again if there's something that you missed. A couple of other things you need to know. If you liked what you heard tonight and you want to hear Dr. Wood speak further about The Lord of the Rings, he is coming back to Tyler on January the 12th from 9 a.m. to 12:30 p.m. at Green Acres Baptist Church under Womenary. And if you want any more information about that or you want to register for that, you can go to womenary.com. That's womenary.com. Again, I want to thank Ralph Wood for his lecture tonight. You don't know how much I appreciate it. But I also want to acknowledge his wife, Susan. Oh, Suzanne, I'm sorry, how embarrassing. Suzanne, would you stand up for just a minute? I just want you to know that she is here with him as well. And Suzanne is as delightful as she is, or as he is. Also, a couple other people to thank. Obviously, my wife, Linda, who is my love, my counsel, and my soundboard in more ways than she or you will ever know. Also, to thank Lindsay and Daniel Boone, who have helped a lot with this, to thank Shane McGuire, to thank Chris Gaston on sound back there, to thank Philip Dancy, and all the leadership of our church and the congregation of this church who were able to share these facilities with us. There's one other person that you need to know about that needs to be thanked as well, and he is not here tonight. He is on a special meeting in Portland, Oregon, but he's a man I met a few months ago and who has come to be a great friend and encourager, and that is Mr. Fred Smith. If you don't know about him, it's a very good chance that the reason you're here today is because of him, even though you don't know that. Also, Philip mentioned earlier that I'm part of a Kalos Foundation. That is a K-A-L-O-S Foundation. And we have been trying to support this and future endeavors. And the goal in this particular foundation is to investigate how the arts integrate with our faith, with a purpose to show us how to more deeply love and to follow God. And if you're interested in that, you can look up kalosfoundation.com, all one word, K-A-L-O-S. Foundation.com. So if you would like to help support these future events where brilliant men and women will be invited to Tyler to teach us things, then please join us in all that effort. The last thing I want to mention is there was a last-minute change in the lecture topic tonight, but I want to thank Ralph for that as well. I don't know if you're a big fan of The Hobbits, and some of you may think that they're really nothing more than a ground squirrel or something like that. But after his talk tonight, I'm now going to be forced to do something I don't like to do, and that is, of course, to examine my own heart. Because now, in view of his illumination of that book, I'm going to have to reflect on my calling. I'm going to have to reflect on the world's order. I'm going to have to reflect on God's providence, and I'm going to have to reflect on the most difficult thing at all, how to give myself away. Can a book transform a life? I think it can. Good night, and God bless.